You're listening to a podcast from 702.
702.
The Naked Scientist.
It's 25 minutes, or rather 26 minutes to 3 o'clock. We conclude the show today, every Monday, in fact, with the session with the Naked Scientist, and we're taking your questions. Good afternoon, Chris.
Oh, hi, so how are you?
I'm very good, thank you. We had a really beautiful moment where we could actually see not just the moon, of course, up in the night sky, but on Saturday night you could also see Jupiter and Saturn. And I thought, how extraordinary when you think of exactly how far these planets are, and that what is coming back to us? Because they looked like stars, Chris. Of course, the moon appeared as it normally does, not quite full, but ultimately we could see these other two planets like little twinkling stars, pretty bright on Saturn.
Yeah, you're observing something called a great conjunction.
Mm.
A conjunction's when you see the two stars in the sky next to each other, and a great conjunction is when it is exclusively Saturn and Jupiter.
Oh.
And this happens about every 20 years, actually, because it's to do with the time it takes the planets to orbit, because the orbital time for Jupiter is about 12 years. In other words, one Earth year for the Earth to go completely around the Sun. For Jupiter to do that equivalent journey on Jupiter's orbit takes just shy of 12 years.
Mm.
And for Saturn, which is further away, to do that same journey, 30 years. And this means that Jupiter is effectively lapping Saturn inside its orbit.
Wow.
And after about every 20 years, the two planets end up catching one another up and appearing in the same spot on the sky.
Yeah.
And that's what you're seeing at the moment. So this last happened in the year 2000. It will next happen in 2040. So it's a special year this year. It's apparently at its peak in December of this year.
Mm-hmm. Oh, beautiful. Also, we'll keep seeing them this year.
Yes,
again,
because obviously they're moving relative to us, and because they're so far away, the actual amount of movement between the two planets is low where from our vantage point, because they're covering such enormous distances that they're literally going to pass close and then drift off apart again. So it's right through until December that you're going to see this spectacle. And Jupiter's the big, bright, white one. Jupiter is, of course, a huge planet. It's reflecting a lot of light back from the Sun, which is why it looks white.
Yeah.
Saturn is further away and smaller. And that one is also reflecting light, but because it's being hit by less light, because it's further away, it looks dimmer. It also looks an interesting orange color as well. So the bright white one is Jupiter, and then underneath it is Saturn.
Yes.
And it's a bit yellower.
Oh, beautiful. It was so beautiful to just step outside and you're reminded about how small you are in relation to everything else, actually. We're taking calls this afternoon on 011-883-0702, 31702 for your SMSs, your WhatsApps and voice notes on 072-702-1702. We go to Kamu first in Midrand. Hello, Kamu.
Yes, how is it?
Good.
Good, 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 good. Thank you. Hiya, Chris.
Hi.
Yeah. I guess the flavor of the moment is viruses. I have an interest in zinc and how it affects ribosomes in terms of zinc concentration in a cell or deficiency in zinc. How does that affect ribosomes and how they replicate DNA, please? RNA in particular, sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. Well, remember that ribosomes don't replicate RNA. Ribosomes are made of RNA. They're made of ribosomal RNA. And they read the message that's on RNA, which has been transcribed from DNA, which is the core recipe book. And you make an RNA called a messenger RNA copy, which goes across the ribosome and it reads it a bit like a barcode scanner, effectively.
Yeah.
And it turns the message that's on the RNA message, messenger RNA, into a protein. And I'm not sure what the role of zinc is in that specific process. But people are interested in zinc because it's a trace element, it's a micronutrient, and you need some of it in your body to be healthy, but too much is unhealthy. And zinc is a heavy metal. It can get into your brain and it will cause neurological injury if you have too much of it. So there's a lot of people saying you should take zinc supplements because this is good for your immune system and it's good for fertility and all this kind of thing. I'm not sure what the evidence really says on any of that. It's a bit like these vitamins are a bit like engine oil in a car. Enough oil in the engine makes it run sweetly and keeps it running sweetly. Too much is a bad thing.
Okay. Kamu?
Yep.
There's your answer.
Perfect.
Thank you. Kamo out in Midrand there. And then Andrew in Hammanskraal. Hello, Andrew.
Hello, Azania.
Hello.
Dr. Chris, hi. It says here, scientists have learned how to encourage clouds with, I mean, clouds to unload their water by seeding them with chemicals. I just want to know what this seeding means.
Hello, Andrew. This is a long-standing phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, as you say, called rain seeding. And the way it works is that you fire up into the sky tiny particles, and various chemicals are used. Silver iodide is famously used because it's very, very good at doing this seeding. What happens when you put tiny particles into the sky that also happen to be water-loving, which silver iodide fits the bill, water molecules, which are water vapor in the air, like to gather together, and because they're sticky, and they find it easier to gather where there's already other water molecules gathering. Mm-hmm. So if you give them a site to start forming a droplet, they'll gather around it. So the idea of rain seeding and cloud seeding is you fire this big plume of particles into the air, water droplets begin to form around those particles, and when the air or the droplets become sufficiently large that the up currents of air can no longer hold them aloft, they come down as rain. And if you do this in the right place at the right time, you can make it rain where you want it to rain, ideally, and that means you deprive things downwind of that rain that it would have had. And that can be useful. Sometimes it can be destructive, but it can be useful. The Chinese did this before the Beijing Olympics to keep the weather pristine.
Yes.
They also turned off all the industries for a while to get the air to be a bit cleaner, so no one noticed how polluted Beijing was at the time. But that's how they got the weather to be so reliable, because they caused the clouds to drop all their rain upwind of Beijing, so that when the air flowed across Beijing, it was deprived of all its water and there was no rain to fall.
Right. Yeah, he's gone. Andrew is gone, but I hope he's listening on the radio. Great answer there, Chris. And let's go next to Cindy, so in Pretoria. Hi.
Hi, Cidiso, yes.
Oh, it's Cidiso.
I've got a question. Mm-hmm. I've got a question here. I just want to find out if water could filter through glass. I've noticed that if you pour cold water into a glass, it takes seconds for a glass to be wet outside, even on the surface where you put it. Can I squeeze in a second question quickly?
Mm-hmm.
I want to find out if it happens when an astronaut takes a spacewalk from the space station. If it happens that he separates away from the station, what will be his fate?
All right. So listen,
two quite different questions.
Very different.
So
but it's
the
not
first one about
the glass, is it?
Going out into the air.
Mm.
When you have got a glass and you put cold water into it, you make the glass cold.
Yeah.
The air contains a certain amount of water vapor. This is called humidity. And in certain climates and certain geographies, the air is more humid. And warm air, on average, is more humid than cold air, because warm air can carry more moisture. When the air hits a cold surface, it loses energy to that surface. The cold surface robs the air of its energy. If the temperature of that patch of air drops, it can't carry as much water anymore. The water vapor, the water molecules, are brought closer together, and that means that they join up and they form a droplet, and that's condensation. And the reason that's happening is, as I say, you've got your glass, you've put it in some air, and you've put cold water into it, so the glass has become cold, and it's now robbing the air of energy, and that is what is causing the water the moisture to condense on the outside of the glass. Your astronaut spacewalk question.
Mm-hmm.
The reason astronauts are very, very careful when they go outside their spacecraft is if they detach themselves from the spacecraft, there is no way to get back.
Yeah.
Because when we walk around on Earth, we're using Isaac Newton's laws, one of them being the third law: for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, which is that if I want to walk forward, I push down with my legs against the ground, and the ground pushes back on me and pushes me along, and that's how I make progress.
Mm.
In space, there is nothing to push against. So you can throw your arms and legs around and you'll just flail around and move nowhere. So if you've been given a push and you start flying away from your spacecraft, there is nothing for you to push against to get back. The only way to get back would be to create a force equal and opposite to the one that propelled you away from the spacecraft,
yes,
in the first place, and a bit more to then reverse the momentum and take you back to your spacecraft. Yeah. There is a story that someone lobbed a tool in space because they had become separated from their spacecraft. I'm not sure if this is true or if it's just apocryphal, but they got separated from their spacecraft, so they threw their tools, and by giving the tools a push in one direction, the tools would have pushed back on them with an equal and opposite force, accelerating them back the other way, and that enabled them to get back to safety.
Oh.
Your fate otherwise is to drift aimlessly in space and never get back. You'll run out of oxygen and then you will die in space, entombed in your spacesuit.
Yes, and that running out of, that's what kills us, right? The lack of oxygen.
Yes, or you can cook because it's incredibly hot in space.
Yes.
The radiation from the sun is unattenuated by any atmosphere. Beer, which is why spacesuits have tinted visors and so on. And the spacesuit also reflects a lot of light from the surface, and it contains some insulation to stop you getting very cold. So one half of you would get very, very hot, the side facing the sun. The other half of you would be facing deep space where the temperature is close to zero, and therefore you'd be freezing cold. So
yes.
Half of you'd be hot, the other half would be freezing cold. Not very pleasant once you've run out of energy to keep your spacesuit in the ideal conditions for you to live in it.
Would a jetpack not work?
Well, if they've got a jetpack, they're fine, because yes, the way a jetpack works is it's throwing molecules. You're using gas or something, and you accelerate that gas. And if you apply a force accelerating the gas in one direction, it will apply an equal and opposite force back to you, giving you a push of equivalent magnitude the other way.
Yeah.
And so when you want to go in one direction, you fire the jet in the direction opposite to the one in which you want to move, and you then move. But often these spacesuits are bulky enough as it is. They don't have a built-in jetpack. The astronauts use their attachment to the spacecraft to manipulate and maneuver themselves.
Yes, yes. That was fun. Let's go to Bongani in Randburg. Hello, Bongani.
Hi, Aza. How are you?
Good. Welcome.
I'm good. I've got a question for Dr. Chris.
Yeah.
What kills a person in a bullet? Is it the bullet itself, or is it something else that is poisonous in a bullet?
Okay.
Right, okay. There's a number of factors to this. In the good old days, when people fired musket balls at each other, very often these were going quite slowly by the time they hit somebody. They may have done damage, but what they very often did was to lodge inside the body, and they were filthy, and they would have carried through the clothing and the skin, which was also filthy, muck, debris, dirt, and bacteria. And very often, people, if they didn't die of the direct impact of the bullet hitting them and the wound it imparted, they would die of secondary infection when the bullet lodged somewhere in their body.
Mm-hmm.
These days, we have high-velocity weapons, which usually they kill people outright, especially if they hit one of the vital parts of the body.
Yeah.
And the reason they do that is that it's not the... If you weigh a bullet, it doesn't weigh very much, but it's got enormous amounts of energy. So when it hits you, it creates a shockwave through your tissues, literally tearing the tissue apart. And if you look at the point where a bullet goes into a person or an animal or whatever, it's a small hole. But if you look on the other side of the body, the damage is devastating because the shockwave has spread out and the energy has dissipated inside the body, tearing tissues to pieces. And it's that tearing tissues to pieces that does catastrophic damage to essential organs and blood vessels and causes people injuries that are often lethal.
Right. So it is the injuries caused by the bullet, Bongani. I hope you're clear on that. Does that answer your question sufficiently?
It does. Thank you very much, Doctor.
Fantastic. That's Bongani in Randburg. We've got Jim in Randburg as well. Hi, Jim.
Yes, hi. It's a very simple question. I need a sort of yes or no answer. If you were appointed a COVID advisor to the British or South African government, would you advise, on the basis of current scientific evidence, the ban on tobacco products to be continued? So it's got to be yes or no.
I would say yes. Now, let me justify my answer. I justify my answer because, one, I'm a non-smoker, and therefore I can smugly say we should ban fags because they're really, really bad news. They cause 7 million deaths a year around the world.
Mm.
Easy for me to say. Very hard for people who smoke and enjoy smoking. That's their right and their privilege. So it's not simple. I acknowledge that. But if one looks at the benefit that could be accrued by getting people to stop smoking, and this might be one stimulus that helps them, because if you ask smokers, 75 to 90% of smokers say they want to not be smokers. But the success rate of giving up smoking is about 10%. So lots of people want to quit. Hardly anyone does. It often takes some kind of nudge or push to help people go down that journey, and then the health benefits are absolutely enormous. There is nothing you can do that's better for your health in the long run than stopping smoking. So, as I say, easy for me to say, I don't smoke, I'm a doctor, I have a vested interest in holding these views. Hard for people who are smokers, who are facing a ban on cigarette smoking. But sometimes something like this can help those proportion of people who really want to get off smoking to make sure they do, mm-hmm. and to remain non-smokers. So I think for me it would be a yes, but it's a sort of a supported, countenanced yes. And I have a conflict of interest because of the job I do.
Right. Thanks for your question, Jim. And you gave him more than just the yes or no. Let's go to Tyrone.
Well, I did
next.
Give him the yes or no, but yes. Then I explained myself.
Exactly.
I think it's important because otherwise it will come across as just a very biased answer.
Tyrone, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Uzi. Aza?
Yes.
I want to ask why crocodiles can't stick their tongue out.
No. Where did you observe this, Tyrone?
From school.
Oh, great. Chris, any thoughts?
I didn't catch the question, sorry.
He wants to know why crocodiles can't stick their tongues out.
I've never been asked that question. And I think it's probably because they wouldn't want to catch them in their jaws. Some animals have very long tongues for a reason. If you think of things like frogs and lizards, they catch flies with their tongues. Snakes have a long forked tongue because they're using it as a chemical sensor. They're actually tasting the air and pulling in molecules from air, which they then insert on the tips of their tongues into structures called Jacobson's organs in the roofs of their mouth so they can taste their environment. Crocodiles use other senses. They're sensitive to vibration, they're sensitive to smell, sensitive to temperature. They've got eyes so they can see where their potential dinner's coming from. So they don't need to use their tongue for that. They do have tongue structures to help them to swallow, I think, but I've never seen a crocodile bite its own tongue. So I think the likelihood is that they don't do it for that reason, if nothing else.
Thank you for your question, Tyrone. We have Sipho in Woodmead next. Sipho?
Hi, guys. The question that I have for you, Chris, is based on this Elon Musk guys from space. The question I have is, what if the guys stay there for more than a year in space? Will there be any chance in that period that they get flu or get sick from flu, cold and flu? That's my question.
Okay. Did you get that, Chris?
I didn't catch that one too clearly. Can you just summarize for me? Sorry
yes.
about that.
So if a guy goes up in space, right, stays there for 100 years, I mean 100 days rather, Sipho, I don't know the connection to Elon Musk. Was someone sent up?
No, I'm just saying
okay.
my point is if the astronauts were to stay for longer than a year,
would they
in
catch?
That period, is there a chance of them getting flu?
Yeah.
Right. The only place you're going to catch a human infection from that you don't have already is another human.
Mm-hmm.
Because influenza, yes, there are forms of influenza that are carried by birds and they spawn pandemics in the human race periodically. But the seasonal flu that comes to us each winter is given to us by other people. And that's true of the vast majority of infections that assail humans. We catch them from each other. And when people go into space, the group of people who are on the International Space Station have come through a very rigorous quarantine process on the ground. Astronauts are quarantined before they go to make sure they haven't got anything nasty because it could jeopardize a mission. And these missions cost millions per hour to run. And you're playing with very expensive equipment and people's lives. And you can't take those sorts of chances. So no chances are taken. Astronauts, cosmonauts, taikonauts if you're Japanese, they all go into a quarantine, they're checked beforehand to make sure that they aren't carrying or going to give anything to each other, and then they go up to the space station. So when they arrive at the International Space Station for their period in space, then they won't be carrying any of these common colds or affected by them at that time, and therefore the likelihood of there being an outbreak of these diseases while they're up there, which could be catastrophic, is extremely remote. Not impossible, because you can never say never in medicine, but they take all the steps they can to make sure that they're not going to get outbreaks of infectious diseases, because you can't just call a doctor. I mean, obviously there are doctors who go on these missions, but if someone has a health emergency, it is very, very difficult to get them back home and do that in a safe way that's quick. So you take the maximum steps that you can to make sure it doesn't happen in the first place, and prevention of infectious outbreaks is one of them.
Right, so that's Sipho in Woodmead. And now, Chris, I mean, I've been putting off this question for quite a while, but I came across it again when we had that moment in the night sky on Saturday night. How do we have 365 1/4 day? You know, because 2020 is a leap year, and I've just been looking at different explanations around leap years and how we make up, of course, for that quarter extra day. But just how do we have 365 1/4? What is a quarter?
Well, what's a day? A day is how long it takes the Earth to rotate completely once.
Yeah.
And it just so happens that is about 24 hours. The Earth is not just spinning on its own axis, though. The Earth is also going in a giant circle around the Sun. And it just so happens that because of the size of the Earth and where we are in relation to the Sun, it takes the period of time it takes us to go on one complete lap in the, it's not a circle, it's actually an ellipse around the Sun, is 365 and a bit days. And we're calling a day how long it takes the Earth to rotate. So it's not surprising that it's not a complete number of Earth rotations, because the time it takes the Earth to rotate once has got nothing to do with how long it takes the Earth to go in a big circle around the Sun. It's just we're using that as a convenient measure, a day, a period of time, and then the size of the giant circle that the Earth follows all around the Sun, that's a totally different measure. And we're measuring that in terms of Earth days, and that's why there's not a precise number. You'd be a bit surprised if it was a precise number, actually.
Yeah, I think that's it. So, as you said, it's just a way, it's just a tool. It's not necessarily an actual quarter.
Well, it's a period of time.
Yes.
And you're timing the planet on its journey. You could time a car around a racetrack,
yeah,
and you're timing it in seconds. You could time it in whatever you wanted to. You could time it in days. You'd have a fraction of a day for however long it took the car to make a complete lap. We're timing the amount of time it takes the Sun to do a lap of the solar system in a period of time we call a day, which happens to be 24 hours.
Perfect. Okay. So now I'll work my way around the Gregorian calendar to also better understand how we make up for that. But we seem to be out of time. I was hoping that we'll speak to Lisiba. Lisiba is a crocodile farmer. I think he wanted to respond to Tyrone's question. Hello, Lisiba.
Oh, good. Yeah, let's get that.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I was just saying that the crocodiles don't have tongues. And they don't.
They don't. Excellent. Okay. That's very useful to know.
So what do they have, Lisiba?
They don't have tongues. They, because they swallow, they don't chew their food.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
have they not got a sort of structure in the floor of the mouth and at the back of the throat, which effectively is analogous to a tongue structure, which helps them to push the food back and then down their throat?
Yes, it's just, I think mostly it's just, I think it's for stopping water from going in.
Okay.
Because sometimes they can swallow inside, but mostly that is why they feed outside.
So, Lisiba, how do you know?
I'm a crocodile farmer.
So just from observing them, no other kind of up-close contact? No, luckily, because you're still here. thank you, Lisiba. Thank you for that. On Tyrone,
that
I hope you're listening.
That's my fact of the week I've learned today.
Yeah. It's helped all of us, in fact. And thanks to Tyrone.